petition number 11308, Rule 1. Yeah.
It's not all that difficult. I am a Welshman, of course, and it's G-W-I-L, Gwil, Y-M. It isn't Gwilym, and it isn't Gwilym, or anything like that. It's just Gwilym. And I like to be called Wing Commander. Well, normally I do, anyway. I don't care what you call me, really. But Gwilym is Gwilym, and Lewis is Lewis, and it isn't very difficult. But English chaps can't handle it, and so I've mostly gone around with a nickname or Bill. that's what my name is. I would like to get that more or less right. All right.
Right. It's Wing Commander Gwilym Lewis, Reel 1.
Mr. King, you've got me at rather an awkward period in my life, because I'm now 93, and not as quite as versatile as I have been in the past, and I think you will understand that from the comments as I make them. At the outbreak of war on August the 4th, 1914, I was at Marlborough School at the age just coming up to 17. That was rather young to join up. They wouldn't take you, they didn't really want to take us until we were about 21. My brother, very promptly at 19, joined up and went out to the Dardanelles and later flying, etc. But my father was keen for me to pass an exam, and I suppose it was the type of the matric or something of that sort. I passed it, but it enabled me to specialise quite a lot in my training as a cadet in the usual thing at what was it called?
It's the OTC.
The OTC. So at the time that I was 18, I became quite efficient in the OTC and enthusiastic, and I was in a good position to get a commission. In any normal army battalion, my father knew the commanding officer of the Northamptonshire Regiment, and so I took a commission in about the middle of 1915 in that battalion. Unfortunately, I assumed a view that this was really rather too much like hard work. All those long walks they used to go for with sacks on their backs and that sort of thing. And I was only lasted about three weeks, and I went to the colonel and told him I would like to fly. That meant joining the Army Royal Flying Corps. He was absolutely furious. I suppose he had some hopes for a young officer. And We had quite a tussle where he stopped my pay and so on. I then went to the Air Ministry to apply to join the Royal Flying Corps, and I saw the intake major, and he said, "I'm very sorry, young man, but we don't have any spare intake at the present time." He saw how disappointed I looked, and he said, "Well, I tell you what you could do. You could probably go to a private school and take your certificate, and then we would almost certainly take you on." So I then went to Hendon, to the LMP School of Flying, and learnt to the elementary part of flying on a Codron. We had no dual control. We had to take ourselves off into the air gradually to stages. This Codron was a single-seater with a 35-horsepower, three-cylinder radial Anzani engine. And as you imagine, it went over tick, 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 tick. But after a normal period, I was successful in getting my certificate. At that point, the Royal Flying Corps were prepared to take me in. I might say that in the meantime, the colonel stopped my pay, which I think was quite wrong, because I really was out to serve my country as best I could, but we had this difference of opinion. And from there, perhaps I should go back a step and say that when I initially told my father that I wanted to go flying, his reaction was, blah, 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 very dangerous, young man, very dangerous. But I said to him, well, Dad, you haven't heard the whole story yet. It's going to knock you back £100. But he took that, as he took most things from his family, pretty well in his stride eventually. Well, from there, I was posted to the Royal Flying Corps and started further training at Farnborough. That was quite interesting. It's the first time I'd had any dual control on an aero and so on, but they did have a more powerful Codron there, which none of them seemed to like at all. I believe it had an 80-horsepower Gnome engine in it, a rotary engine, of course, and I was successful in flying this. I think they rather hoped I would crash it, but I got quite fairly pleased with it, and then I flew other types, particularly the Avro. And from there, I was posted to the Central Flying School in quite early part of 1916.
So if I can just ask, if the instruction you got at Farnborough was the first time that you had any dual control, how did the London and Provincial spend your £100 teaching you to fly at Hendon? What did you get for your £100 there?
I got my training in this 35-horsepower Codron. First of all, we learnt in stages. We learned to roll along the ground, then we learned to get our tail up as we rolled along the ground, so we were nearly airborne. Then eventually we did straights across the airfield and got up to 20 or 30 feet. That's where a number of crashes, of course, took place. And from there, we had to do what was required of the certificate, that is to say, figures of eight over the aerodrome and landing on a mark without your engine on from about 500-600 feet, something like that. And that I got, and I have my certificate to this day. So I didn't have any dual control. Mm-hmm. I had one flight with the owner of the school, and we went round in a two-seater Codron, which had about a 45-horsepower engine, so it could carry two people. And I was delighted with that because I didn't get giddy and I didn't have any worries at all. It seemed to be a very pleasant way of going around. But I had no idea what flying was all about. That was my first flight, the only one I had with anybody else during the couple of months I was at Hendon. That was in 1915. So, does that answer your question?
Very much, thank you.
Question. From there, I was posted from Farnborough, which was a very nice station. Nice, cheery lot of young fellows there. Posted to Central Flying School at Uphaven. And I hated the idea of going there. And in process of time, I might say that I grew very, very fond of it. It was highly efficient, probably the most efficient training spot in the country. I then could describe a bit of the type of flying that I seem to quickly get involved with some very little dual control, because I'd had that at Farnborough, on a bloater. I always regarded that as a pig of an aircraft. It was rarely a B-2A, which had a wheel, not a joystick, and warped wings, no ailerons. And fundamentally, a rotary monocipat engine. This gave it a degree of instability and quite difficult to control. But in a way, I was rather glad I was made to fly this aircraft, because it was quite difficult, and I took it very gingerly. From there, I progressed. I flew a B-2C, which was very easy to fly, very stable aircraft. I remember I'd already done probably about 12 or 13 hours, determined to do a loop. Well, I'd had no teaching of how to do a loop, but I understood you put your nose down, then pulled the stick back and went over. I did a very bad loop. It took me quite a long time to get to decide that I could do it. But I know at the top of the orbit I was hanging onto the joystick, so I didn't think I was doing a big one, and then the cushion in the front seat fell out. So however, I came round again and I'd done a loop, and nobody else of my section had done that, so I'm quite happy about it. But I got from the bloater successfully to the Vickers gun bus. Maybe I flew one or two other types in the meantime. But this was on the way to a pusher type aircraft, as you know, and it was a two-seater with the gunner in the front seat and with a Lewis gun. With a rotary engine, there was a good deal of torque, as there usually is, and bad swing taking off, and I frightened a lot of people because I swung into the hangars and people would start to run, I remember, but I just managed to take off in time and did a quiet little swing turn to the other way, and everything was all right. But there were those difficulties, but it wasn't a particularly difficult aircraft to fly. At that point, I'd got my wings, quite accustomed to flying across country and so on, and was headed for the DH-2. I was madly keen to get onto the DH-2, which led me into 32 Squadron, which was forming up at Netherhaven, across the valley. I had a limited amount of experience on the DH-2, and by the grace of God, I was sent to 32 Squadron. Most of the other chaps flying with me went to fly the to 27 Squadron with the Elephant. What was that?
Martinside
Elephants. But I didn't want to do that. That's where they went, and two or three of us came across to 32 Squadron, where Reese was in command. Now, do you want me to go on with that period? Age. And got to know Major Reese. I wrote home to my parents and said, this commanding officer of ours is a marvelous chap. Knows all about the aircraft. He can knows how to rig the DH-2. He knows how to handle the gnome monocipat engine, 100 horsepower, and of course has already had a fine record overseas with number 11 Squadron, won the Military Cross. I said he's a gentleman. He's a marvelous chap, And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if he doesn't come back with the VC. The strange thing is, it's exactly what did happen. For a short time, we were getting together as a squadron. The squadron was rather late taking off because it was depleted. Its numbers were depleted by casualties in the two previous DH2 squadrons. Number 24 was the first one, and they were down in the Somme area, and number 29 was the next one. They were up in the Ypres area. They had their wastage, not necessarily war casualties, and we were in 32 having to feed them from that squadron. So we were rather later taking off than we expected, but there were a cherry lot. I suppose there was some experience amongst the flight commanders, but nothing very much. We took out with us two little Vickers bullets, which were a tractor aircraft, pretty looking, but Rees and Hellier, my flight commander, flew them, but later on discarded them in favor of the DH-2, which they preferred because of the visibility out of this Vickers aircraft wasn't to their liking, although they were quite good performers. Well, after a few days, we reached the takeoff period, and we all set off in pretty good order, one after the other, forming into groups and landing at Folkestone for lunch.
Was Folkestone a fairly large transit point even then?
Folkestone was a fairly good airfield there. Yeah. We had lunch at the big hotel there, and then proceeded from there to fly to France. It was, of course, all quite stimulated. I think there were two fellows who didn't make it at that point. Some engine trouble along the way. But otherwise, we made a very good flight to France, to Saint-Paul. Saint-Omer, pardon me. Saint-Omer, which was a kind of center point for aircraft and pilots before being assembled into the line.
Was it unusual for a whole squadron to arrive together, or even was two losses considered good going at that?
Well, it was very much better than the other DH2 squadrons had done themselves. Certainly much better than 29 did, who had quite a number of problems. I don't remember precisely what they were, but basically we flew over in better order than the other two squadrons had. So I don't know much about other squadrons going out overseas, except my own. We landed there, and except for two or three, one fellow just... I was a little excited crossing the channel. It was a new experience to me. My engine wasn't running perfectly. There was a little pop-pop going on, which kept me slightly anxious, but we made it, and I made it to it. And so we were in France. You hold on a minute.
It's about your position in the squadron.
Yes. Well, all right, I've got... Go on.
What was your position in the squadron at this time?
Well, those who had difficulty in flying across the first time joined the squadron in the course of a day or two. I myself was the youngest member of the squadron. I was 18 years old, and I suppose a pink and white boy, the youngest in the squadron, and I had the nickname of Cherub. Strangely enough, that name stuck with me more than any other in my career in the Royal Flying Corps and the Royal Air Force. Not very long ago, I had a letter from a Marshal of the Royal Air Force addressed to me as Dear Cherub, which looked rather ridiculous at my present time of life. Well, we assembled and took up a position at a service airfield at Ayr, and proceeded first of all to find our way on the lines and get accustomed to places. I seemed to fly about and visit other squadrons. There was a good deal of freedom amongst pilots in those days. They were very much granted freedom, really. I think it was good training for them. I seemed to have friends in quite a number of squadrons which I visited. And then we patrolled the line. First of all, in what we would call line patrols, perhaps alone or perhaps two of us. And whilst doing one of these line patrols, we'd perhaps get up to about 12,000 feet. That was the aircraft didn't take us very much higher than that, but that was a good height. Well, I was flying just our side of the lines when north and south on a patrol, when I saw in the distance another aircraft coming at about my own height into my direction. So we were on opposite courses, of course. Well, in case it was an enemy aircraft, I placed myself between it and the lines, seeming to cut him off if he was a problem. And I don't deny the fact that my heart jumped into my mouth when suddenly I saw its markings of the black crosses. I immediately turned around to get a shot on at him, and I sprayed him with bullets, but I wasn't as cool and collected as I would like to have been. I was quite excited. He turned as quickly as he could, and he was a Roland two-seater, very good German fighter type of aircraft. I could see the goggles of the gunner who was behind, and his gun, and I was really quite close. He then turned, and I turned after him again. I wasn't as good a pilot as I was in later times, but I had then sprayed him again, and he managed to turn under me and dive for home. By the time I'd come round again, he was on a dive. I felt rather elated that I'd sent him on his way home, and I think possibly, because he didn't seem to fire at me, it's possible that I may have put a bullet into the gunner, I don't know. But certainly I got back home, pleased myself. Victor, I sent him on his way home anyway. And the commanding officer, Rees, expressed considerable disappointment and said I'd missed an opportunity of shooting him down. Anyhow, I wasn't criticized but on what I tried to accomplish, but it was that my tactics were... it was reported by another aircraft who said he saw me that I opened fire too long a range. So I was asked how long the range it was, and I said, well, I think I said 200-300 yards. Well, of course, it wasn't. It was near 40 or 50 or 30. And I could see all the detail of the other aircraft very clearly. However, I was very inexperienced. I had very little flying, really, compared to what chaps got later on. And that was the first time in the squadron that anybody had opened fire on enemy aircraft.
Had you actually had any gunnery training at all?
No, I had very little training, really. I really wasn't handling the aircraft terribly well. I knew later on a lot more about that, of course. But there was an incident I had during my training period when I got into a spinning nosedive at the Central Flying School. Well, that was because of the excessive torque of the engine brought the nose down on the left turn, and I was doing vertical turns, and it was at 3,000 feet, and I only just managed to get, I tried everything on the way down, and only just managed to a hollow in the ground to straighten out and switch my engine on. In the meantime, the commandant of the Central Flying School had seen me coming down, and he was a bit overweight and had run up the tarmac and was very upset about everything, but because he didn't like what he saw. However, I was up again in the afternoon again. So there was something still to be learnt about handling the DH-2, which came with experience. It was a marvellous little aircraft, very manoeuvrable, and when we reached the battlefront, there was they were having problems with the Fokker monoplane. The Germans had produced this monoplane, which could fire straight with a gearing straight ahead through the propeller, and was good at diving and had some good pilots, particularly like Immelmann. Well, production of that Fokker was based on a Frenchman who had, with a deflector behind his propeller, metal taken the way of firing straight ahead, and he shot down three or four German aircraft, and the Germans got into a panic, and they went to Fokker and said, produce something quickly, we must have something. And he did, he produced this very very successful Fokker monoplane, which was too much of a problem for our B-2Cs and other rather slow flying aircraft we had around the time. So there was a lot of worry on the battlefront. Well, we handled all that quite quickly and put these Fokkers pretty much out of business. And so we, in process of time, got quite a reputation on the battlefront. I should have said that we took over the center section of the battlefront. That was the First Army. The Second Army was up on the coast, and the Third or Fourth Army was down towards the Somme. Well, we were closely associated with the 25 Squadron, who were flying.
Is it FE-8s?
Not FE-8s. Big bombers, big pusher bombers. And they liked us very much because they had trouble, especially when they were turning after a bomb raid, and the Fokkers would manage to close in on them. They never lost an aircraft when we were escorting, and so we made a good reputation with them. And the whole of the battlefront there, so far they were contacted with flying, were pleased with 32 Squadron. We had quite a good reputation.
So did you consider yourself one of the elite squadrons, having this this machine and the reputation that you were building up?
Very much so. The Fokkers kept away from us because we could outmaneuver them. That was the point. We couldn't catch them in a dive. They dived very well. But they could get away. They didn't come over our side of the lines. Germans never did very much. But they kept away from us as much as they could, and we were thereby in a position to protect the Army Cooperation aircraft, who were doing their working with the gunners and doing bombing and so on. They were not interfered with, so they were much appreciated too. So we were on that front when the Somme battle started on July the 1st, I think, 1916, on that day, Reese was up in his DH2 and ran into a party of 8 or 10 DFW two-seaters and put up an amazingly good show and was awarded the VC. The report on that fight is available in many books.